The Synthesis of Yoga, Sri Aurobindo. The final chapter of the introduction, Chapter 5, The Synthesis of the Systems. By the very nature of the principal yogic schools, each covering in its operations a part of the complex human integer and attempting to bring out its highest possibilities, it will appear the synthesis of all of them largely conceived and applied might well result in an integral yoga. But they are so disparate in their tendencies, so highly specialized and elaborated in their forms, so long confirmed in the mutual opposition of their ideas and methods, that we do not easily find how we can arrive at their right union. An undiscriminating combination in block would not be a synthesis, but a confusion. Nor would a successive practice of each of them in turn be easy in the short span of our human life and with our limited energies, to say nothing of the waste of labor implied in so cumbrous a process. Sometimes, indeed, Hatha Yoga and Raja Yoga are thus successively practiced. And in a recent unique example, in the life of Ramakrishna Paramhansa, we see a colossal spiritual capacity first driving straight to the divine realization, taking, as it were, the kingdom of heaven by violence, and then seizing upon one yogic method after another and extracting the substance out of it with an incredible rapidity, always to return to the heart of the whole matter, the realization and possession of God by the power of love, by the extension of inborn spirituality into various experience, and by the spontaneous play of an intuitive knowledge. Such an example cannot be generalized. Its object also was special and temporal, to exemplify in the great and decisive experience of a master soul the truth, now most necessary to humanity, towards which a world long divided into jarring sects and schools is with difficulty laboring, that all sects are forms and fragments of a single integral truth, and all disciplines labor in their different ways towards one supreme experience. To know, be, and possess the divine is the one thing needful, and it includes or leads up to all the rest. Towards this sole good we have to drive, and this attained, all the rest that the divine will chooses for us, all necessary form and manifestation, will be added. The synthesis we propose cannot, then, be arrived at either by combination in mass or by successive practice. It must, therefore, be effected by neglecting the forms and outsides of the yogic disciplines, and seizing rather on some central principle common to all, which will include and utilize in the right place and proportion their particular principles, and on some central dynamic force, which is the common secret of their divergent methods, and capable, therefore, of organizing a natural selection and combination of their varied energies and different utilities. This was the aim which we set before ourselves at first when we entered upon our comparative examination of the methods of nature and the methods of yoga, and we now return to it, with the possibility of hazarding some definite solution. We observe, first, that there still exists in India a remarkable yogic system which is in its nature synthetical and starts from a great central principle of nature a great dynamic force of nature. But it is a yoga apart, not a synthesis of other schools. The system is the way of the Tantra. Owing to certain of its developments, Tantra has fallen into discredit with those who are not tantrics. And especially owing to the developments of its left-hand path, the Vama Marga, which not content with exceeding the duality of virtue and sin, and instead of replacing them by spontaneous rightness of action, seemed sometimes to make a method of self-indulgence, a method of unrestrained social immorality. Nevertheless, in its origin, Tantra was a great and puissant system founded upon ideas which were at least partially true. Even its twofold division into the right-hand and left-hand paths, Dakshina Marga and Vama Marga, started from a certain profound perception. In the ancient symbolic sense of the words Dakshina and Vama, it was the distinction between the way of knowledge and the way of Ananda. Nature in man liberating itself by right discrimination in power and practice of its own energies, elements, and potentialities, and nature in man liberating itself by joyous acceptance in power and practice of its own energies, elements, and potentialities. But in both paths, there was in the end an obscuration of principles, a deformation of symbols, and a fall. If, however, we leave aside here also the actual methods and practices and seek for the central principle, we find, first, that Tantra expressly differentiates itself from the Vedic methods of yoga. In a sense, all the schools we have hitherto examined are Vedantic in their principle. Their force is in knowledge. Their method is knowledge, though it is not always discernment by the intellect, but may be instead the knowledge of the heart expressed in love and faith, or a knowledge in the will working out through action. In all of them, the Lord of the Yoga is the Purusha, the conscious soul that knows, observes, attracts, governs. But in Tantra, it is rather Prakriti, the nature soul, the energy, the will in power executive in the universe. It was by learning and applying the intimate secrets of this will in power, its method, its Tantra, that the Tantric yogin pursued the aims of his discipline. Mastery, perfection, liberation, beatitude. Instead of drawing back from manifested nature and its difficulties, he confronted them, seized, and conquered. But in the end, as is the general tendency of Prakriti, Tantric yoga largely lost its principle in its machinery and became a thing of formulae, an occult mechanism still powerful when rightly used, but fallen from the clarity of their original intention. We have, in this central Tantric conception, one side of the truth, the worship of the energy, the Shakti, as the sole effective force for all attainment. We get the other extreme in the Vedantic conception of the Shakti as a power of illusion, and in the search after the silent, inactive Purusha as the means of liberation from the deceptions created by the active energy. But in the integral conception, the conscious soul is the Lord. The nature soul is his executive energy. Purusha is of the nature of Sat, the being of conscious self-existence, pure and infinite. Shakti, or Prakriti, is of the nature of Chit. It is power of the Purusha's self-conscious existence, pure and infinite. The relation of the two exists between the poles of rest and action. When the nature is absorbed in the bliss of conscious self-existence, there is rest. When the Purusha pours itself out in the action of its energy, there is action, creation, and the enjoyment or ananda of becoming. But if Ananda is the creator and begetter of all becoming, its method is tapas, or force of the Purusha's consciousness dwelling upon its own infinite potentiality in existence and producing from it truths of conception or real ideas, vijnana, which proceeding from an omniscient and omnipotent self-existence have the surety of their own fulfillment and contain in themselves the nature and law of their own becoming in the terms of mind, life, and matter. The eventual omnipotence of tapas and the infallible fulfillment of the idea are the very foundation of all yoga. In man, we render these terms by will and faith. A will that is eventually self-effective because it is of the substance of knowledge. And a faith that is the reflex in the lower consciousness of a truth or real idea yet unrealized in the manifestation. It is this self-certainty of the idea which is meant by the Gita when it says, Yoyak Shraddha Sa Eva Sa. Whatever is a man's faith or the sure idea in him, that he becomes. We see then what, from the psychological point of view, and yoga is nothing but practical psychology, is the conception of nature from which we have to start. It is the self-fulfillment of the Purusha through his energy. But the movement of nature is twofold, higher and lower, or, as we may choose to term it, divine and undivine. The distinction exists indeed for practical purposes only. For there is nothing that is not divine. And in a larger view, it is as meaningless verbally as the distinction between natural and supernatural. For all things that are natural. All things are in nature, and all things are in God. But for practical purposes, there is a real distinction. The lower nature, that which we know and are and must remain so long as the faith in us is not changed, acts through limitation and division, is of the nature of ignorance and culminates in the life of the ego. But the higher nature, that to which we aspire, acts by unification and transcendence of limitation, is of the nature of knowledge and culminates in the life divine. The passage from the lower to the higher is the aim of yoga, and this passage may effect itself by the rejection of the lower and escape into the higher, the ordinary viewpoint, or by the transformation of the lower and its elevation to the higher nature. It is this, rather, that must be the aim of an integral yoga. But in either case, it is always through something in the lower that we must rise into the higher existence. And the schools of yoga each select their own point of departure or their own gate of escape. They specialize certain activities of the lower prakriti and turn them towards the divine. But the normal action of nature in us is an integral movement in which the full complexity of all our elements is affected by and affects all our environments. The whole of life is the yoga of nature. The yoga that we seek must also be an integral action of nature, and the whole difference between the yogin and the natural man will be this, that the yogin seeks to substitute in himself for the integral action of the lower nature working in and by ego and division the integral action of the higher nature working in and by God and unity. If indeed our aim be only an escape from the world to God, synthesis is unnecessary and a waste of time. For then our sole practical aim must be to find out one path out of the thousand that lead to God, one shortest possible of shortcuts, and not to linger exploring different paths that end in the same goal. But if our aim be a transformation of our integral being into the terms of God existence, it is then that a synthesis becomes necessary. The method we have to pursue then is to put our whole conscious being into relation and contact with the divine and to call him in to transform our entire being into his. Thus, in a sense, God himself, the real person in us, becomes the sadhaka of the sadhana, as well as the master of the yoga, by whom the lower personality is used as the center of a divine transfiguration and the instrument of its own perfection. Sadhana, the practice by which perfection, siddhi, is attained. Sadhaka, the yogin who seeks by that practice the siddhi. In effect, the pressure of the tapas, the force of consciousness in us dwelling in the idea of the divine nature upon that which we are in our entirety, produces its own realization. The divine and all-knowing and all-affecting descends upon the limited and obscure, progressively illumines and energizes the whole lower nature, and substitutes its own action for all the terms of the inferior human light and mortal activity. Stopping on page 46, this was the first half of chapter 5, The Synthesis of the Systems.